I do want to first just acknowledge that this presentation is collaborative work with Steven Shapiro, who, at least until next Monday, is the National Infertility Prevention Project Coordinator, and then he'll be taking on a new title then. I also want to thank. IPP is not going away. Not going away. I also want to thank Kevin and Sevgi for inviting me to be part of this symposium. It was a lot of fun putting this talk together. Not only did I get to sit and have great conversations with Steve about the program, what programs are doing, but I also got to talk to many folks in the field as I was gathering the examples I'll be highlighting today. So thank you. For the presentation this afternoon, I'll start with some general background on. I don't know where my background slide is, but for the presentation this afternoon, I'm going to start with some general background on chlamydia epidemiology and screening recommendations. And then I'll use most of my time to highlight some ways project areas have used their local chlamydia data to target and prioritize interventions. And I've kind of grouped my examples into two groups. So first, I'm going to talk about ways programs have used their data to increase prevention program efficiency. And in that section, I'm going to give two examples. I'm going to talk about ways programs have used their data to target testing. And then I'm also going to talk about how programs have used data to pool their laboratory specimens. And then I'm going to discuss some ways programs have used data to identify opportunities to improve program. And then finally, I'll come back together for some conclusions. So chlamydia is a bacterial infection which can lead to adverse reproductive health outcomes. Recent data suggests that about 10 to 15% of untreated chlamydial infections result in clinical pelvic inflammatory disease. Chlamydial infections are usually asymptomatic in females, so many women are infected and don't know it. Fortunately, when infections are identified, they're easily treatable with single-dose antibiotics. Chlamydia is the most commonly reported nationally notifiable disease. Based on preliminary data, there were 1.4 million cases reported in 2011. Reported case rates are highest in young women aged 15 to 24 years. However, as chlamydia is usually an asymptomatic disease, case rates are heavily influenced by screening coverage. So the more we look for chlamydia, the more we find it, and we've been looking for it more. So this graph shows HEDIS, which is Healthcare Effectiveness Data and Information Set data. HEDIS is a tool used by more than 90% of America's health plans to measure performance, and one of their indicators is chlamydia screening coverage in young women. And you can see since 2001, screening coverage among females aged 16 to 24 years has increased in both Medicaid and HMO settings. Currently, about 60% of females targeted for screening are screened, compared to less than 30% which were screened in 2001. I do want to draw your attention, though, to the different styles of lines. So the solid lines are screening rates among females aged 21 to 24 years, and the dotted lines are females aged 16 to 20 years. And you can see in both settings, the older women have higher screening rates. And even though screening coverage is higher in older women, the burden of disease is actually higher in adolescents. So this chart shows data from NHANES, which is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. NHANES is a nationally representative survey that samples from the general population. NHANES participants aged 14 to 39 years are tested for chlamydia. And you can see that among sexually active adolescent females in NHANES, so that's the light blue bar on the left, chlamydia prevalence was 6.8%. So that means if you were to take a random sample of the general population of sexually active adolescent females, almost 7% of them would have a prevalent chlamydial infection. Overall, chlamydia prevalence is highest among young women, as indicated by the two bars highlighted here. And you can see prevalence is less than 1% among women aged 25 to 39 years, which is the small blue bar on the far right. So because chlamydia is common in young women, usually asymptomatic, and can cause adverse reproductive health outcomes, we have annual screening recommendations for females. In the STD treatment guidelines, CDC recommends annual screening for all sexually active women aged 25 years or younger and older women with risk factors, such as women with new or multiple sex partners. To help increase access to routine annual screening, the CDC funds the Infertility Prevention Project, or IPP, which is not going away. IPP supports chlamydia and gonorrhea screening and treatment services for low-income sexually active women. IPP funds are primarily targeted to family planning and STD clinics and is implemented in collaboration with the Office of Population Affairs. IPP began in 1988 as a demonstration project in the Pacific Northwest and was expanded to all 10 DHHS regions by 1994. As part of IPP, project areas collect data on tests conducted in sites participating in IPP. And because these data are test-based, not just reported cases, this allows for the calculation of positivity. So it's the number of persons testing positive divided by all the number of people tested. In addition to test result data, core variables such as patient demographics, age, race, and gender are collected by all sites, and enhanced variables such as risk behavior data are collected by some project areas. IPP data are used at the national, regional, and local level. At the national level, the positivity data submitted through IPP supplements our surveillance case report data. And at the regional and local level, data are used to inform effective allocation of resources to maximize the impact of the program. And the rest of my talk this afternoon is going to highlight some of the ways programs have used their IPP data to target and prioritize their limited data or their limited resources. So the first example of increasing prevention program efficiency is targeting screening. Because we have annual screening recommendations, one way to target chlamydia screening is really just to get providers to adhere to the screening guidelines. As a reminder, the CDC recommendations are for annual screening of sexually active women under 25 years and older women with risk factors. And my first example of how to increase adherence to screening guidelines comes from San Francisco. So this is actually where Carol referenced in his talk, and I'm going to give some more details about what San Francisco did. So San Francisco developed local chlamydia screening criteria, and based on their local data, they decided that the population targeted for screening should be women age 25 or younger, and women who were pregnant or having an intrauterine device or IUD inserted. So these are in line with CDC guidelines, so young women and older women at increased risk. And San Francisco came up with these screening criteria, and then they attempted to work with their local providers to get them to adhere to them, and they tried site visits, they tried giving them data feedback, but they felt like their attempts really weren't successful. And in 2008, 64% of their chlamydia tests completed in 8 family planning clinics were among females age 26 or older. And San Francisco interpreted this to mean that they were over-screening older women. So they undertook a structural intervention to ensure compliance with their local screening criteria. And what they did was to remove other as a reason for screen on their public health lab requisition slip. So you can see on the lab slip on the left labeled 2008, it states a reason for chlamydia or gonorrhea testing must be checked, but that one of the reasons a provider could check was a write-in field of other. On the revised lab slip in 2009, that reason was removed, and the only 3 screening-related reasons matched their criteria of less than 26, pregnant, or an IUD insertion. And then using data on this lab slip, the San Francisco lab rejected any specimen without a valid reason for testing. So with this intervention, a provider couldn't order a chlamydia screening test for a woman over 26 unless she was pregnant or having an IUD inserted. So this intervention really forced providers to adhere to the screening criteria. So did it work? Well, San Francisco compared chlamydia test data from their 8 family planning clinics in 2008, so that's the pre-intervention old lab slip, to 2009, the post-intervention new lab slip. And for females age 26 or older, they saw a 24.4% decrease in the number of tests completed, and a 4.3% increase in positivity. And when they translated that into cost, they found that the intervention decreased the average cost per case identified by 3.5%. And San Francisco estimates that saved them almost $40,000 in 2009. And if you want to learn more about this intervention or see some more of the data, I would suggest reading Kyle Bernstein's paper, which was published in STD in February of last year, or since he's in the audience today, you can ask him during the Q&A or stop him afterwards. Okay, so we've talked about screening guidelines or targeting screening by increasing adherence to screening guidelines. I'd like to talk now about strategies to target screening in low prevalence settings. So although chlamydia screening is recognized as being cost-effective, screening is likely not cost-effective at low prevalence levels. Based on modeling, it's estimated that screening is only cost-effective at 3% prevalence in family planning clinics. So to maximize limited resources, screening really should be targeted to populations with at least a minimum prevalence. So CDC implemented a national structural intervention to maximize limited resources. Beginning in 2009, all funded project areas were asked to ensure that their IPP-funded sites had a positivity of at least 3% among women aged less than 26 years. Project areas were asked to report site-specific positivity in their annual reports and to develop plans to assure 3% positivity. So those plans included things like better targeting of resources within sites. So for example, if based on their local data, they found low prevalence in women aged 20 to 24, they could target their screening towards adolescents. And if targeting screening within a site didn't increase positivity to over 3%, project areas could also reallocate resources to sites with a higher burden of disease. And I have this slide titled by what this intervention is often referred to as, and that's the 3% rule. So as an example, how did implementing the 3% rule work in Kentucky? Well, in 2008, 75 sites participating in IPP in Kentucky had a positivity of less than 3% among women under 26 years. So Kentucky Department of Public Health targeted interventions to those low positivity sites, and they used a number of different strategies. So they provided site-specific positivity reports. They suggested that sites with low positivity use a risk-based screening criteria. And then they provided individual technical assistance to a limited number of sites. So how did it work? Well, by 2010, Kentucky had reduced the number of sites with a positivity of less than 3% by 28%. So they went from 75 sites to 54. But because of the large number of sites with continued low positivity, Kentucky still has its work cut out for them, but they already have some next steps identified. So their plans are to target high-volume sites. They identified that 21 of those 54 conduct over 100 tests annually. And in those high-volume, low-positivity sites, they plan to intensify communication with providers as well as involve their quality improvement team. Okay, so shifting now from providers to the lab, my next example of using data to increase prevention program efficiency is about pooling specimens. All right, so for those of you that aren't familiar with specimen pooling, it's a laboratory technique of combining individual specimens and testing them as a pool so that only those pools containing a positive specimen require individual specimens to be screened separately. So for example, in group A, 7 specimens are pooled together and only 1 test is run on that pool. And since that pooled test is negative, you know all 7 specimens are negative, so you only have to do 1 test instead of 7. But in group B, 2 of the 7 specimens are positive, so when the pooled test is run, it's positive, and that triggers running the specimen separately. So in this situation, pooling requires running 8 tests instead of for only 7 specimens. So the cost effectiveness of pooling is really impacted by prevalence. So you could see if you had a low prevalence population, you'd have a lot of pools like group A, you'd only have to run 1 test for every 7 specimens. But if you had a high prevalence pool, you'd have to run 8 tests for every 7 specimens. So pooling really is most useful when you can identify low prevalence pools. So in 2009, the Idaho Bureau of Laboratories investigated if using patient data collected on their IPP lab slip could increase the efficiency of their program. So they developed a pooling algorithm to identify low prevalence pools using reason for visit. And reason for visit is one of the enhanced variables collected by IPP sites in Idaho. And it's a patient-reported measure of what brought them to the clinic that day. So the first thing the folks in Idaho did was look at their historic positivity data by reason of for visit, and they used that information to figure out which kind of reasons were high positivity and which were lower positivity. And in looking at that, they found higher prevalence of chlamydia among women who reported they had been exposed to chlamydia or gonorrhea or another STD, or were there for rescreening, meaning they had been previously diagnosed with chlamydia or gonorrhea. And this identified that that patient data indicating one of these reasons should be tested individually. But for the remaining reasons of visit, they found lower positivity compared to the other ones, so they decided to pool these specimens, and they did so by reason type. So how did it work? Well, in July 2009, the lab received almost 1,300 specimens. Using their algorithm, they only had to run 727 tests to identify all of the positive specimens. Assuming a cost of $14.47 per test, that gave them a savings of 47.4% of their positive cost. The lab estimates that using pooling based on this algorithm, using routinely collected IPP data, allowed for testing of 15,201 specimens for a price of only 8,666 specimens. And if you'd like more details on this project, I'd direct you to a paper published by Joanna Lewis and colleagues earlier this year in STD. Okay, so we've spent some time talking about using data to improve program efficiency. I'd like to switch gears now and talk about how programs have used data to identify opportunities to improve their programs. And first, I'd like to give an example of regional work that was done to look at screening during pregnancy test-only visits. In 2009, CDC supported a project to systematically look for opportunities to improve program. Specifically, it was a regional assessment to identify which family planning users were not being screened for chlamydia, again with an objective of identifying opportunities to increase screening. So within each region, programs reviewed routinely collected data and some collected additional data. And the project a priori focused on pregnancy test only visits, as previous work had identified high chlamydia positivity among women asking only for a pregnancy test. And that makes sense since asking for a pregnancy test is really a marker of recent unprotected sex. So again, all regions conducted this assessment. I'm just going to highlight one region today, and that's Region 1, which is in the northeast region of the country, includes Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. And Region 1 found that among women attending family planning clinics with a pregnancy test only reason for visit, few are screened for chlamydia. I have the table broken down by age, and you can see even though screening coverage is highest in adolescents, still less than a quarter of clients are screened for chlamydia. Again, these are young women who are accessing care and admitting to a recent unprotected sexual encounter. I know absolute counts are also useful, so here you can see the absolute number of missed opportunities to screen at-risk young women. In just 1 year, almost 25,000 young women who were targeted for chlamydia screened were missed. So this assessment is just the first step in improving programs. The next step, which I think Region 1 is working on now, will be to intervene to increase screening at these encounters. For example, offering provider education on the importance of screening for chlamydia during pregnancy test-only visits, and structural interventions like establishing standing orders and electronic medical record pop-ups. And if you'd like to hear more about Region 1 works on pregnancy test only visit, I'd encourage you to stop by poster 103 this evening. Jennifer Kwatu, who's also in the audience today, will be presenting on some of their more recent 2011 data. Okay, so I have one more example for you on identifying opportunities, and that's on data on timely treatment. As I mentioned at the start of this talk, once a chlamydial infection is identified, it's easily treatable with single-dose antibiotics. And prompt treatment of chlamydia reduces duration of infectiousness and further transmission of disease. Measurement of treatment timeliness is one of the CDC performance measures. It's specifically among female clients, what proportion of women with a positive chlamydia or gonorrhea test are treated within 14 or 30 days of the treatment of the diagnosis date. So the Illinois Project Area, which is all of Illinois except Chicago, looked at this performance measure to see how they were performing. And this table provides the proportion of female clients with reported chlamydia who were treated within 14 days. And I have data presented by provider type for year 2008 and 9. And you can see that in STD, family planning, and other health department clinics, about a quarter of females were not treated within 14 days. And Illinois couldn't tell from their data if these patients weren't treated in 14 days or if they were treated and it's just that treatment wasn't documented. And they thought that it actually might be a little of both. So they undertook activities to improve this measure that would address both issues. So they first looked at their data by clinic and identified clinics with high timely treatment rates, so to find out what were the best practices in those clinics. And then they targeted clinics with low rates of timely treatment to see if they could get them to adopt some of those best practices. So first, to decrease any reporting barriers, they facilitated fax transmittal of case reports to providers who had been previously been mailing their reports. So they decreased any barriers to getting the data into them. Then to increase timely treatment, they reviewed clinic-specific performance measure data with clinic staff, and then worked with them to develop action plans to improve timely treatment, such as counseling patient at the initial exam about the importance of timely treatment, and obtaining the partner's contact information the patient's contact information at the initial exam. And then they followed up with quarterly data to let clinics know how they were doing. So did it work? Well, you can see here they have a pretty good success story. So in 2010, 90% of cases in STD and health department clinics were reported as having treatment within 40 days, and 86% of cases in family planning were timely treated. Okay, so with that last success story, I'm going to wrap up with some conclusions. So routinely collected chlamydia test data are routinely used to improve program efficiency and to maximize resources. Hopefully, one of the themes you picked up on throughout the talk was all of these interventions began by looking at the data. We often collect data, and then it sits on our computer, or we make pretty graphics for our reports or our presentations. However, these projects were successful at improving their program because they looked at their data and then they used it. I've only highlighted a few examples of the amazing work that's being done. I did a quick tally of the conference program this week, and there are over 20 abstracts being presented this week, which use IPP data, the majority demonstrating how IPP data are used to improve program. Still, more needs to be done. Data such as those collected by IPP are most useful at the local level, and regions and projects areas should encourage local data collection and analysis to inform programs. Our national surveillance data suggests that chlamydia prevalence is decreasing in some populations. And as prevalence decreases across more populations, we'll need to figure out how to identify and target those most at risk. And then finally, we need to think about how we can maximize screening among at-risk women outside of traditional public health facilities. All of the examples I provided today were from public health. However, the majority of chlamydial infections are diagnosed in the private setting, so we really need to reach out to our private partners to continue to maximize program efficiency. So I'd like to once again acknowledge my co-author, Stephen Shapiro, along with my colleagues listed here, who helped me identify the great work that I was able to showcase today. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that very nice review. I was interested in the Kentucky data. So it looked like they had some initial success, and they're going to go back, and they have this high-risk group that they're going to intervene with further in terms of QA measures. But what if they can't get that percentage up above 3%? Is there any reason to think that maybe we should take the dollars that are being spent in those clinics and come up with some innovative ideas outside of family planning clinics where we might use those data, use those resources?
Right, absolutely. So the 3% rule is really, or the intervention that I call the 3% rule, is really just about targeting the dollars. And so, as I said, you know, working with clinics to get their 3% up, I don't think all of the sites in Kentucky are going to be able to get that 3% up. Part of these are rural communities. It's probably the only clinic in that community. It's going to be hard to get it above 3%. So they'll continue to work with them. You know, one of the options project areas have is, as you suggested, to reallocate resources to other settings. And it doesn't have to be just family planning. There are a number of clinics participating in IPP where there is higher prevalence. Yes.
I understand that most of the chlamydia infection are asymptomatic, particularly in women using the pill. So it came controversial ideas the pill protect against chlamydia, while in fact the pill reduced the immunity of the woman. So instead of having a very active immune inflammatory response, would become subdued and the chlamydia does not present as an infection, it would be asymptomatic. What's your comments about that?
So that's interesting. I haven't heard that. I agree with you that the majority of chlamydia infections are asymptomatic in women. The research that I've seen around oral contraceptives is that oral contraceptives can increase cervical ectopy. So the cells on the lining of the inside of the cervix can go to the outside of the cervix, which can increase chlamydia transmission as well. So we often think of hormonal contraceptives, particularly in young women, as increasing their risk for chlamydia infection. I hadn't heard the piece about the symptomatic part of it.
The same thing applied to the tube. Mm-hmm. The tube that have a very flimsy single layer of columnar epithelium. And this layer, the immune response, the innate immune response of that mucosa gets subdued by birth control. So it would not manifest as an acute infection like gonorrhea. So women, particularly on the pill, they don't have much symptom when they have chlamydia, so it's assumed that the pill really protects against chlamydia, while in fact, most of the infertility caused by tubal obstruction are caused by chlamydia. After they do the pathology and after they do the laparoscopy, they find indeed the tube is blocked because of scarring secondary to chlamydia.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
one thing about the 3% rule, and I've argued with Steve Shapiro about this for years. A lot of family planning clinics test people that are not in our high-risk criteria. Mm-hmm. But they test those women using resources other than IPP dollars. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ought to be in the business of pulling IPP money out of the place because they've elected to test a higher number of people using insurance dollars or other resources. And I think that can discourage the whole concept of testing people. If we're going to say, well, we're going to pull our money because you're at 2.9%, but you're at 2.9% because you elected to test a bunch of people using resources other than ours.
Right.
So I think sometimes when you have to look at these places individually, and it can become very counterproductive if we apply that too stringently when they're, again, using non-public health dollars. If they want to do that, God love them.
I agree. And I think one of the things that I learned is that when I started this with the 3% rule, that I really thought it was if they weren't at 3%, they pulled their resources from them. And I was quickly educated by Kevin and Steve that it wasn't that it just a pulling of resources. The first step really was working with the clinic to find out, well, who are you testing and how can you target your testing to be testing the right population? But I think you bring up some of the challenges of the IPP data in general is that it is a really there's a lot of heterogeneity in the data that we get from IPP. We don't know a lot about the clinics and the population being tested in it. Yes, David.
Wonderful, Lizzie. I was particularly moved by the San Francisco intervention to reduce screening that shouldn't happen. And I have a bias that we should try to reason with people and interact and in good faith. I'm also aware of a state health department that intervened with a similar problem without any conversation. Mm-hmm. They simply examined the extent to which each clinic was doing screening outside the project criteria and calculated the number of tests and sent a bill to the clinic and expected payment. And they too found a very significant reduction in tests outside. So I think the breadth of interventions can be stretched,
But
there may be a downside to that more rigorous, more one-sided approach.
Unintended consequences. John.
Hi, Lizzie. John Pfister from HCET in Madison, Wisconsin. Wanted to have you address a few issues regarding the pooling data. We've used it very successfully for men admitted to correctional institutions, but there are three issues that I wonder if you could address. One is the theoretical, if not the demonstrated decrease in sensitivity with pooling. Second is the increase in time, so it takes you longer to report out a positive because you have to do additional testing. And the other is the logistical difficulty in the laboratory for doing the pooling and possibly introducing some laboratory error. Could you address those, please?
Probably not to the extent you would like me to. Because to be honest, so I found this paper and was so excited by what I found in it that I called the Idaho lab and talked to them a little bit about it. So I really only know the extent to what I presented here in terms of their use of the IPP data and as a way to increase the prevalence or to identify low and high prevalence pools. So unfortunately, I really can't kind of talk to some of those issues. But if somebody else can, perhaps they can. Oh, look, and there's a hand there. So maybe we can talk about that afterwards. But I'm getting a note from my moderator. Do we need to move?
I think we should
move on. Okay, thank you.
One more time for one more question. Quick one.
Let's wait till the end. There's one more speaker.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
So thank you very much, Lizzie. That was really great. I think this is more than we could have hoped for from all our speakers. So our last speaker is actually a local STD control prevention program director, and we thought it would be appropriate to end the session with somebody who's actually on the local level and who lives this, isn't looking at it from Atlanta, but looks at her own data and tries to assess the data and move programmatically based on what she sees. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Susan Black from New York City.